Welcome to the Cabinet of Science and Fiction. Today we're embarking on a truly mind-bending deep dive. We're looking at one of modern science fiction's, well, most ambitious and thought-provoking sagas. Imagine a story that spans centuries, confronts humanity with this existential alien threat, and really explores the most profound questions about our place in the universe.
Oh, absolutely. It's a series that's been praised, you know, for its immense scope, its scientific rigor, it's captivated readers worldwide. It even caught the attention of prominent figures like former U.S. President Barack Obama. He called it immense, said it made his day-to-day problems seem fairly petty.
That is high praise. And what really elevates Lou Sixon's Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy, most people know it as the Three-Body series, what elevates it beyond, say, typical sci-fi is its unflinching willingness to take these theoretical concepts and push them to their most logical and often terrifying conclusions. You've brought us a fascinating stack of sources outlining the plot, the characters, the groundbreaking scientific ideas in these books. So our mission today is to unpack these core concepts, the epic narrative, and the chilling implications of this hard science fiction masterpiece. We'll be tracing humanity's journey basically from first contact all the way to its ultimate fate in this vast, maybe indifferent cosmos.
It's a narrative filled with incredible twists.
Wow. Yeah.
Ethical dilemmas, too, and scientific concepts that really stretch the imagination. They force you, our listener, to reconsider everything you thought you knew about, well, interstellar relations and humanity's place in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our journey begins with the three-body problem. Now, this novel doesn't just start with an alien invasion, not at all. It roots itself in this pivotal, quite tragic moment of human history. It sets a deeply personal foundation for what becomes a cosmic conflict.
It starts in China, right? During the Cultural Revolution.
Exactly. We're introduced to the astrophysicist Yi Wenji, and she experiences this profound trauma, witnessing the brutal public denunciation, the death of her father, who was a respected physicist, during a struggle session.
Horrific. And that event, it completely shapes her worldview, doesn't it?
It really does. It sows these seeds of deep disillusionment with humanity. I mean, she basically loses faith in us and our ability to govern ourselves or even act with basic decency.
And that disillusionment is so critical. It's what drives her subsequent actions, makes her a really complex figure, not just a simple hero or villain.
No, not at all. Later, she's sort of a political outcast, and she gets recruited to this highly secretive military initiative. It's called the Red Coast Project.
Right, Red Coast. And their goal is pretty ambitious.
It's huge. Find and establish contact with extraterrestrial life. That's it. And it's here, at this remote, isolated base, that Yi Wenji makes this, well, groundbreaking, but also deeply personal and ultimately catastrophic decision.
She figures out how to use the sun, yeah, as an amplifier.
Exactly. Use the sun itself to amplify a radio transmission, sending Earth's first message out into the void.
And then she gets a reply.
Yeah, unbelievably. After 8 long years, a reply. And not just any reply, it's from a planet called Trisolaris, 4 light years away, Alpha Centauri system. But here's the chilling part. Instead of celebrating this monumental discovery, Yi Wenji, she's still consumed by this despair, this disillusionment with humanity's self-destructive ways.
So she invites them.
She invites the Trisolarians to Earth. She sees them not as invaders, but almost as saviors, hoping they'll come and fix humanity's problems, basically by force. She's given up on us saving ourselves. And this single desperate act, it sets the stage for everything that follows, seals Earth's fate for centuries.
It's a choice born of just profound despair. Kicks off the whole saga.
And that desperation, like you said, it leads us to understand the chaos on Trisolaris itself, which explains why they jump at her invitation with such determination to invade.
Right. Imagine a planet, right, caught in this orbital dance around not one, not two, but 3 suns, a ternary star system.
Not just a pretty sky.
No, it's a constant existential threat because of the three-body problem in orbital mechanics. Basically, the gravitational pull of 3 bodies like that, it's inherently chaotic, unpredictable.
So for Trisolaris, that means what? Wild swings in climate?
Wild doesn't even cover it. The planet is constantly plunged into these devastating, chaotic eras, periods of extreme climate catastrophe. We're talking boiling oceans one century, the atmosphere freezing solid the next, sometimes for hundreds of years.
Not just bad weather, then. We're talking total collapse of ecosystems, civilization.
Exactly. The sources say hundreds of Trisolaran civilizations have risen and fallen. They just can't predict or prepare for these planet-shattering, chaotic eras. They've tried rewrite everything, apparently. Calendars, technology. Nothing works against that fundamental unpredictability.
So Earth looks pretty good from their perspective.
Like paradise. Stable, hospitable. A safe haven from their perpetually doomed world. So their motivation for invasion is pure survival. Driven by this desperate need, they send out their invasion force. A colossal fleet. And get this, the journey is estimated to take 450 years.
450 years. That gives you a sense of the scale, the desperation, and their long-term planning.
Oh, unimaginable.
So if the Trisolarans are that desperate and their fleet is centuries away, what's their strategy? They can't just wait. They aren't just sending ships. They're playing chess across centuries, aiming to kneecap humanity's progress long before their fleet arrives.
And this is where their really ingenious and frankly terrifying solution comes in, the Sophons.
Ah, the Sophons. Right. Explain those again.
So the Trisolaran leadership, they're worried about Earth's tech catching up, right? They fear that by the time the fleet gets here, we might be too advanced.
Makes sense. 450 years is a long time for us technologically.
Exactly. So their solution, Sophons. These are minuscule supercomputers embedded in single protons.
Protons? How do they even do that?
Well, they use their advanced particle accelerators to literally unfold 11-dimensional protons down to just 2 dimensions. Think about that. A fundamental particle existing in maybe 11 dimensions, like some theories suggest, they flatten it out, like cosmic origami. And on that incredibly flat subatomic surface, they etch microscopic supercomputers.
That's mind-blowing. It's a blend of theoretical physics and just insane engineering.
It really is. And once the circuitry is in place, these Sophons can refold themselves back into 11 dimensions, or maybe unfold into just the 4th, 5th, or 6th dimension. This makes them larger, observable to us in a way, but they don't change mass. And crucially, they can move through our 3-dimensional space at light speed.
Okay, so tiny light speed supercomputers made from protons, what do they do?
They have a dual purpose, and it's chilling.
Yeah.
First, surveillance. They are omnipresent spies. They literally see and hear everything on Earth, recording visually, beaming info instantly back to other Sophons, and eventually to Trisolaris using quantum entanglement.
So total surveillance. No secrets.
None. They're all-seeing, all-knowing. But the second purpose is maybe even more devastating. Scientific disruption.
Oh.
They actively interfere with Earth's particle accelerators. They can stray into the path of particles being fired, scrambling the results of experiments. This effectively blocks humanity's advancement in fundamental science. It causes research breakdowns.
And that leads to the scientist suicides mentioned in the book.
Exactly. Prominent Earth scientists are driven to despair by the inexplicable failures of their life's work. Physics just stops making sense. The thought of a single Sophon disrupting all of Earth's particle accelerators at light speed. It paralyzes our ability to discover, to understand the universe.
That level of sabotage, it's devastating. How does humanity even begin to fight back against an enemy who can read your mind and break your science?
Well, the first book shows us the struggle to even figure out what's happening. This international task force gets formed, right, to investigate the weird science stuff, the suicides.
And this is where we meet Wang Mio, the nanotech guy, and Shikyang Dashi.
Right, the gruff detective. They're tasked with unraveling this mystery. And as part of that, Wang Liao starts playing this weirdly compelling virtual reality game. It's just called Three Body.
The game. That turns out to be a recruitment tool, doesn't it?
Yeah, created by the Earth Trisolaris Organization, the ETO, this clandestine group of human sympathizers. The game is designed to build empathy for the Trisolarans, showing players what life is like on their chaotic world. It recruits people to their cause.
And Wang Miao gets drawn in, eventually joining the ETO.
He does. And that's where he learns the full truth about the invasion, the Sophons, and also about the big split within the ETO itself.
Right. Humanity's first big division. You've got the Adventists.
They think humanity is beyond saving, basically. They want the Trisolarans to come and wipe the slate clean, fix our problems by getting rid of us.
Yeah. Grim. And the other faction?
The Redemptionists. Surprisingly, they want to save Trisolaris. They think they can solve the three-body problem computationally, give the Trisolarans a stable world so they don't need Earth. A weird mix of empathy and, like, scientific hubris.
So the first book culminates in this big raid, right?
Yeah. Wang Miao tips off Dashi and the military. They raid the ETO headquarters. Yuanji is arrested. And crucially, they seize the ETO communications with Trisolaris.
And that's when Earth's governments finally learn the whole terrifying truth. Trisolaris is real. The fleet is coming.
A total bombshell. Humanity is forced to confront just how vulnerable it is. The game has completely changed.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Book two, The Dark Forest. The stakes go way up. We get this chilling new concept that fundamentally changes everything we thought we knew about the universe.
Right. So humanity knows the fleet is coming, still 400 years out. They try to present this united front.
Mm.
But the Sophons are still there, spying on everything, hindering tech development, making any real military prep incredibly difficult. Humanity is fighting blind.
So how do you plan a defense when the enemy sees everything?
You find a way to hide your plans inside someone's head. That's the wall facer concept.
Wall facers.
Right.
Explain that.
The UN appoints four individuals, gives them almost unlimited power, huge resources, their job. Devise secret defense strategies, strategies that exist only in their own minds. The idea is that human thought, individual consciousness, is the one place the Sophons can't penetrate.
A gamble on the impenetrability of the human mind. But the Trizalurans have a counter.
Of course. The wall breakers. Trizaloran agents, working through human traitors in the ETO remnants. Their sole mission is to figure out what the wall facers are secretly planning and expose them. Turn humanity's best hope against itself.
And this brings us to Luo Ji. He's one of the wall facers, but he seems, well, completely unqualified.
He really does. He's kind of aimless, hedonistic initially. His selection is baffling, even to him. But he's also the only human the Trizalurans actively try to assassinate from the get-go. That makes him unique.
So what's his journey? He doesn't stay hedonistic forever.
No. It starts with remembering this earlier fateful encounter he had with Yuanji before she was arrested.
Back to Yuanji.
She subtly encouraged him back then to think about cosmic sociology. Like the rules governing interactions between civilizations across the universe.
Cosmic sociology. And Luo Ji runs with this.
He does. He eventually formulates these two fundamental axioms based on Yi's hints. Axiom one, survival is the primary need of civilization. Axiom two, civilization continuously grows and expands, but the total matter in the universe remains constant.
Simple statements, but with huge implications.
Exactly. When Luo Ji really thinks through these axioms, applies logic, he arrives at the dark forest theory.
The dark forest. This is probably the most famous concept from the whole series, isn't it? It's just chilling.
It really is. It reframes the entire universe. The theory basically says the universe is like a dark forest at night. It's teeming with countless civilizations, but they're all silent hunters, hiding. Because if any civilization reveals its location, makes a sound, lights a fire, it will almost certainly be destroyed immediately by another unseen civilization.
Why? Fear? Competition?
Both. Based on the axioms, everyone wants to survive, and resources matter are limited. So any other expanding civilization is automatically an existential threat. The safest strategy is to stay hidden, and if you detect someone else, eliminate them before they can eliminate you.
It's a brutal answer to the Fermi paradox, why haven't we heard from aliens?
That's they're all hiding, or they get wiped out as soon as they make noise. Silence equals survival.
So Luo Ji figures this out. How does he prove it?
He does something incredibly daring. He broadcasts the precise location of a specific star, about 50 light years away, out into the cosmos. Then he goes into hibernation to wait and see what happens.
And it works?
Chillingly, yes. When he reawakens centuries later, he learns that star was destroyed by an unknown attacker.
Mm.
His terrifying hypothesis is confirmed.
Wow, so the dark forest is real. What do the Trizalurans do?
They realize Luo Ji has stumbled onto something huge, a way to potentially threaten them by revealing their location. So they immediately deploy these advanced probes to jam any further cosmic broadcasts from Earth. They want to shut down that possibility fast.
Okay, so Luo Ji hibernates again. 2 centuries pass. He wakes up and finds a very different Earth.
He wakes up to this apparent utopia. Humanity seems confident, technologically advanced. They've built this incredible space fleet. There's this feeling that maybe they've outsmarted the Trizalurans during the long wait.
But that optimism doesn't last long, does it?
Not at all. It's shattered in one of the most devastating scenes in science fiction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Earth's entire space fleet, thousands of ships, humanity's pride and defense is completely annihilated by a single Trizalurian probe.
A single probe, known as a droplet.
The droplet. It's terrifying. It's covered in this strong interaction force material, basically harnessing the force that holds atomic nuclei together.
Making it indestructible.
Pretty much. Stronger than anything in our solar system. Impervious to any physical attack Earth can throw at it. Our weapons literally can't scratch it. Plus, its propulsion system seems to ignore inertia. It can make impossible instantaneous turns in 3D space.
So how does it attack?
It doesn't need fancy weapons. It just smashes through things. It ripped through Earth's fleet like paper. Pure, unstoppable kinetic force.
The sheer efficiency. It just crushes all that human confidence.
Absolutely. A handful of human ships managed to escape into deep space after that massacre. But even out there, the Dark Forest logic takes hold. They end up fighting each other, cannibalizing resources to survive.
Proving Luigi's theory again, even among humans.
Exactly. Kill or be killed when survival is on the line.
So this disaster forces Luigi back into his wall-facer role.
Yes. Humanity is reeling. The tries-and-learn threat is renewed. Luigi steps up, but now he has his ultimate strategy ready. He plans to use nuclear weapons, but not to attack Tri-Solaris directly.
What then? To get past the jamming?
Precisely. Use the energy signature of multiple strategically placed nuclear detonations to encode and broadcast coordinates, overcoming the Tri-Solaris jamming. His threat is clear. He will broadcast Tri-Solaris' location to the entire universe.
Inviting destruction from some unknown dark forest hunter?
Exactly. And because Earth is relatively close to Tri-Solaris, destroying Tri-Solaris would likely endanger Earth, too. Mm-hmm. It's mutual assured destruction, cosmic style.
And this actually works.
It does. Tri-Solaris is forced to halt. They divert their invasion fleet. They even agree to share technology, help human scientific progress, all under the threat of Luigi's broadcast. A fragile truce is established.
Based on pure terror.
Pretty much. Later, Luigi has this fascinating conversation with the original pacifist, Tri-Solarin, the one who warned Yi Wenji. They talk about the slim possibility of peace, but it's overshadowed by the Dark Forest reality.
Okay, that brings us to the final book, Death's End, and things get even bigger, even stranger.
Oh yeah, the scale expands massively. The Dark Forest theory almost seems simple compared to what comes next. So, human history continues under this fragile deterrence established by Luigi. This period introduces the role of a sword holder.
The sword holder. The person with their finger on the trigger for the mutual destruction broadcast?
Exactly. The one person authorized to activate the broadcast if Tri-Solaris breaks the truce. Luigi was the first one. Then the narrative introduces Cheng Xin, a young aerospace engineer from our time, the early 21st century.
She gets involved with the Planetary Intelligence Agency, right? And its chief, Thomas Wade.
Yes. And these two characters, Cheng Xin and Wade, they embody this central conflict. Cheng's deep pacifism versus Wade's ruthless belief that the ends justify any means for survival.
And they start this staircase project. What was that again?
An incredibly ambitious, maybe desperate plan. Send a human spy specifically, a cryogenically preserved brain at relativistic speeds towards the Tri-Solaran fleet. The hope that the Tri-Solarans might intercept it, revive the brain, and humanity could learn something.
And Cheng Xin asks her old classmate, Yun Tianmeng.
Right, who is terminally ill with cancer. She asks him to donate his brain. He secretly loves her, which adds this whole layer of tragedy. And before his brain is launched, he did something poignant. He uses a UN fundraiser to buy the rights to a distant star, DH3906, and gives it to Cheng Xin, a gift across time and space.
A gift that becomes important later. Cheng Xin then goes into hibernation.
She does. Jumps forward 200 years, wakes up in a world still living under the deterrence, but things are changing. She finds herself incredibly wealthy, thanks to that star Yun bought her. Turns out owning star rights can be lucrative. And her fame, her perceived gentle nature, leads humanity to elect her as the new sword holder, succeeding the aging Luigi.
And this is a disaster.
Immediately. Tri-Solaris has been watching. They know Cheng Xin is compassionate, maybe too much so for this role. They gamble. She won't activate the broadcast. They launch a surprise attack, disabling Earth's broadcast antennas.
And Cheng Xin hesitates.
She does. She can't bring herself to condemn both species. Her pacifism, her humanity, prevents her from pulling the trigger. Earth's deterrence is neutralized. Tri-Solaris announces the invasion is back on.
But there's one last chance. A ship out in space.
Yes, the starship Gravity. It still has a functional broadcast system. It was originally sent out to pursue another fugitive ship, Blue Space. And here's where it gets wild. Tri-Solaris sends a droplet to destroy Gravity, but the crew of Blue Space intervenes.
No!
They somehow manage to access the fourth spatial dimension, briefly. Think of it like stepping off the 3D plane the droplet operates on. They become untouchable, able to attack the droplet from an angle it can't comprehend or defend against.
Accessing the fourth dimension.
Wow.
And they use this chance to
get revenge. The combined crews of Gravity and Blue Space, realizing Tri-Solaris' treachery, activate Gravity's broadcast system. They broadcast Tri-Solaris' location. And shortly after, Tri-Solaris is destroyed by an unknown Dark Forest attacker.
So the deterrence works, but activated by someone else. What happens to Earth?
The surviving Tri-Solaran ships flee. They know Earth is now also a target because of its proximity to the destroyed Tri-Solaran system. Earth is left alone, but incredibly vulnerable.
This then leads to maybe the most bittersweet moment, Yun Tianming communicating with Cheng Shin.
Yeah. The Trezorans had captured and revived Yun's brain. Now, before their civilization's final destruction, they allow him to talk to Cheng Shin. He can't speak freely, but he tells her these elaborate fairy tales,
which contain coded survival advice for humanity.
Exactly. Humanity deciphers three key strategies from these stories. First, the Bunker Project. Build space cities hidden in the shadows of the gas giants like Jupiter or Saturn to survive a potential dark forest attack on the sun.
Hiding behind gas giants. Okay. Right. Second.
Develop light speed travel. Critical for escape, right? But there's a catch.
The catch being?
It's later banned. Because a civilization capable of light speed is seen as a much bigger threat in the dark forest. It attracts more dangerous attention. So the thing that could save you also paints a target on your back.
A terrible dilemma. And the third strategy?
The Black Domain. Create an envelope of space around your system where the speed of light is artificially lowered. This acts like a shield, making you hard to detect or attack, and it prevents anything from leaving easily. It signals to the universe, we're harmless, we're staying put. Cosmic self-imprisonment for safety.
Wow. Bunker, light speed, but maybe don't use it. Black domain.
Yeah.
So what does humanity do?
Well, decades pass. Cheng Shin hibernates again. The Bunker Project makes progress. But the Black Domain, too complex, it stalls. Meanwhile, Thomas Wade, remember him, the ruthless one, he illegally develops basic light speed travel.
Behind everyone's back.
Yes. He wakes Cheng Shin, argues it's humanity's only real chance, begs for her permission to continue. But Cheng Shin, holding to her principles, fearing the dark force consequences of light speed tech, denies him.
And Wade?
He's executed for his transgression. A brilliant, albeit ruthless, mind lost because of this ethical clash. A really tragic moment.
And then the attack comes, not on the sun, but something worse.
Much worse. Several decades later, a hostile alien power launches a dimensional strike against the solar system.
Dimensional strike? Explain that horror.
It collapses three-dimensional space into two dimensions. Our entire solar system, the sun, planets, people, gets flattened. Compressed into a 2D plane, like a cosmic steamroller.
Can anything survive that?
Not in 3D form. The escape velocity needed to get out of the collapsing area is the speed of light. Since humanity, following Cheng Shin's decision, mostly lacks light speed travel. The vast majority are annihilated, instantly crushed into two dimensions.
Unimaginable. But Cheng Shin survives.
She and her aide, AA, are woken during the attack. They desperately reach Luo Qi on Pluto. He tells them their ship, by sheer chance, contains the only surviving light speed engine, the one Wade built illegally.
Wade's forbidden tech saves them. The irony.
Huge irony. Cheng Shin and AA use it to escape. They become, along with Yun Tianming, wherever he is, and the crews of Gravity in Blue Space, the very last humans in the universe.
Just a handful left. Where do they go?
This is where it gets really mind-bending. Time dilation. Cosmic distances. Cheng Shin and AA travel to Planet Blue, orbiting DX3906, the star Yun bought for Cheng. The trip takes 286 years externally, but much less for them due to light speed travel.
And they find other humans there.
They meet Guan Yifan, a cosmologist from Gravity. He explains the ship crews founded interstellar societies out there. Humanity, or a fragment of it, survived and spread.
Okay, a glimmer of hope. But then things get weird with time again.
Very weird. Cheng and Guan leave AA and travel to nearby Planet Gray. They find these unstable seed elements of a black domain. This seed grows incredibly fast, engulfing the whole DX3906 system in a region of lowered light speed.
Trapping them inside.
Yes, and causing extreme time dilation. When they finally manage to return to Planet Blue, almost 19 million years have passed outside the black domain.
19 million years. Just wow.
Incomprehensible. And during their absence, Yun Tianming had visited Planet Blue.
Yun, he made it there.
He did. And he left them another gift from the Trizalurans. Universe 647. A self-contained micro-universe, a pocket dimension outside the normal timeline.
So they can just live there forever.
That's the idea. Cheng Shin and Guan Yifan move into Universe 647. It's idyllic. They hope to outlast the main universe, maybe see its rebirth in a big bounce, the idea that the universe collapses and expands again.
But there's always a catch in this story, isn't there?
Always. They receive a message from the main universe. It tells them that micro-universes like theirs are actually harming the main universe. They're depriving it of mass needed for the cycle of collapse and rebirth. Their pocket paradise is preventing the universe's natural cycle.
The ultimate moral dilemma, their survival versus the universe's life cycle.
What do you even do? Faced with that choice, recognizing their responsibility, they choose the universe. They decide to reintegrate Universe 647 back into the main universe, returning its mass, a final selfless act. Then they depart on further interstellar travels, leaving the fate of the reborn universe behind them. A truly humbling end to humanity's story.
What an epic. Okay, this deep dive isn't just about the story, incredible as it is. It's built on these amazing scientific concepts. Let's unpack some of those more.
Absolutely. It's the hard science backbone that makes it so compelling. How these ideas shape the plot and honestly mess with your head about what might be possible.
Let's start with sawphones again. Protons unfolded from 11 dimensions to 2, turned into supercomputers.
Right. The sheer audacity of manipulating fundamental particles like that. It's just staggering to think about, taking an atom, flattening it, building on it, folding it back up.
And they can then operate in our 3D space at light speed or even appear larger by unfolding into, say, 4D or 5D space while still being just a proton fundamentally.
And their function, total surveillance and crippling scientific progress by messing with particle accelerators. It makes you think, what if the very laws of physics appear to break down because something undetectable was interfering?
It weaponizes the universe against our ability to even understand it, the ultimate info war and science blockade.
Exactly. That's the real terror of the softens.
Then, the droplets. Indestructible probes made of strong interaction force material.
Yeah, harnessing the strongest force in the universe. Not just tough metal, but something fundamentally immune to our physics. Our weapons literally pass through it or break against it.
And that inertialess movement, making impossible turns. How does that even work?
The books don't specify, but it echoes real-world theoretical physics, like maybe an Alcubierre warp drive concept.
Yeah.
Warping space-time around itself so the probe inside doesn't experience inertia while the bubble moves. Pure speculation, but it fits the effect.
And their attack method? Just raw kinetic force, smashing through fleets. Brutally simple and effective.
Unstoppable.
Okay, curvature propulsion, the light speed travel method. The analogy was soap on a paper boat.
Right. Reducing surface tension to move the boat. Yeah. Applied to space-time, the ship reduces the speed of light around itself, creating a warp bubble that drags it along at light speed, locally obeying the light speed limit, but moving faster relative to distant space.
Similar to the Alcubierre concept again. And it leaves that wake.
Yes, a trail of space where light travels slower. That wake is important. It's detectable. It affects things behind it. It means even light speed travel isn't perfectly stealthy in this universe. It leaves a footprint.
Hibernation technology also plays a huge role. Cryogenics, letting people sleep for centuries.
Initially, it's shown as this tool of the rich, right? Skipping the hard times, waking up in a better future, a symbol of inequality.
But that changes with the invasion looming.
Drastically. Suddenly, skipping ahead to doomsday doesn't seem so appealing to most people. They'd rather live out their lives now. So it becomes less a luxury and more a strategic tool for key personnel, researchers, people needed for a long fight. A tool of necessity.
And then the big one, cosmic sociology, the philosophical core.
Started by Yi Wenji, developed by Luigi, based on those two axioms. Survival is primary and matter is constant.
Leading to the dark forest theory. Everyone is a threat, so hide or strike first.
It paints the universe as this place of silent, constant paranoia. Any signal is potentially fatal. It's why the universe seems quiet, not because it's empty, but because everyone's terrified. Announcing your existence is like declaring war.
And finally, the dimensional strike, the ultimate weapon.
Collapsing 3D space into 2D.
Yeah.
Horrifying to contemplate, flattening an entire solar system.
And survival is impossible unless you can somehow become 2D yourself, which for us isn't an option.
No. And the implication that this might be a recurring thing, that maybe the universe started with more dimensions and has been collapsing patch by patch over cosmic history.
It makes the dark forest seem almost cozy in comparison. The universe itself is fundamentally hostile, or at least mutable in terrifying ways.
It really escalates the existential threat to the ultimate level.
Now, this series, it's not just cool sci-fi. It's sparked a lot of discussion, interpretation. People read a lot into it.
That's right. And these discussions often tap into bigger societal and philosophical themes, making you think about our own world through this cosmic lens. Like the dark forest metaphor. Many readers in China, apparently, see it as reflecting China's position in the global order. It's resonated with nationalist sentiment there, maybe mirroring perceived geopolitical realities.
Interesting. But there are other interpretations too, more critical ones.
Yes. Some critics, like Bourdieu or Liesky, argue the books tacitly endorse certain ideas. Things like world government being necessary, or consequentialism, the ends justify the means, or even reflecting aspects of surveillance societies. They suggest the narrative could be read as supporting extreme measures for the greater good in a crisis. Now, it's really important we state these are interpretations reported in our sources. We're just laying them out as part of the discussion, not endorsing any specific reading.
Understood. Just presenting the discourse. What about discussions around gender? That's come up too.
It has. There's been criticism, for instance, from journalist Evan Lambert about perceived sexism. He points to the author's reported views on needing male logic to balance female irrationality, suggesting this colors the characterizations.
And specific examples cited.
Lambert apparently sees Yi Wenji as a quasi-villain, partly due to her actions stemming from disillusionment, portraying her as maybe untrustworthy or irrational at key moments. He also mentioned a general criticism that many characters can feel a bit thinly drawn, perhaps serving the plot more than being fully realized individuals. But there are counter-arguments. Scholars like Yigang Wang argue the trilogy doesn't promote sexism. Wang points to equal gender participation in science, especially in the first book, and central roles for female characters like Ye Wenji and Cheng Xin. Wang acknowledges different mindsets are shown between genders, but frames it as exploring diverse human responses to crisis, not inherent sexism. Though Wang does concede some gender stereotypes appear, like female characters being described as delicate and soft.
So complex characters, complex interpretations. Again, we're just outlining the critical conversation here for you to consider.
These are the kinds of debates great works of fiction often inspire.
Well, what a journey through the Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy. From that chilling first contact through the dark forest to the dimensional collapse, the search for survival. It really delivers that sense of wonder, doesn't it? But maybe also a heavy dose of existential dread.
It really does. It forces you to grapple with the sheer scale of the universe, the incredible fragility of civilization, and the kind of brutal choices we might face if we ever did encounter alien intelligence. And it leaves you with this profound question, I think. If humanity's fate is ultimately tied into the fate of the entire universe, its life cycle, what ethical responsibilities do we have that go beyond just our own species? Do we owe something to the cosmos itself?
Something for you to ponder as you look up at the stars tonight. Thanks for listening.
Until next episode.